So I guess by now you guys have seen the options available in the poll for podcast names.
My wife is already ahead of me on that.
So you can only stuff the ballot box once per day. Sorry, Jim.
I work in the government. Patience is our key.
Yes. somewhere in there is a joke about you working in the government, meaning you also know how to stuff the ballot box. So
that's what I'm saying, really.
But, all right. So it appears as though there is a front runner, at least in our forums, but we're not going to spoil it. We're going to make people have to go to the forums and find it. But, yeah, so welcome to the soon-to-be-named Armchair Dragoons podcast. And with us tonight, we have Doug. Howdy, Doug.
Howdy.
And we have Jim, who's already started talking. Howdy, Jim.
Yeah. Good evening, everyone.
Yeah. And we're up to episode 4. It's almost like we kind of knew what we were doing at some point here. And, you know, we'll try not to let it go to anybody's head. But, yeah, this ArmchairDragoons.com, when you get a chance, come by, check us out, hang out, check out the event calendar, find out where there's some wargaming near you going on. And before we launch into some fun-filled discussion, we do want to make a note that I'm not even sure you guys know yet. We have had conversations with two different game conventions that we're bringing our events beyond Origins, where, you know, under another flag, we've been running Origins events for the last 5 years, and we are now taking that show on the road. We will be at Origins again, but we're also going to be at Buckeye Game Fest up in Columbus later in the fall, and then next November, we will be in Charlotte, North Carolina with MACE, the Mid-Atlantic Convention and Expo, that's going into their 23rd year at this point with MACE. So we're going to be at least two other conventions next year and possibly some others. So
very good.
Yeah. We're not going to be doing Kriegspiels at all of them. We might do it some of them. But,
huh?
Well, at some point, there's like only so many hours of y'all that I can get because, you know, those things like jobs kind of get in the way every once in a while.
Train others to Kriegspiel.
Yes, well, that is on the table for a discussion for Origins this year now, isn't it?
It is just that.
To turn that into a training thing for us. And so we're going to circle back around to Kriegspiel stuff here in a few minutes. But so a question, Doug, how many Blenheim games do you have at this point?
At least 4.
Okay. I was waiting for you to say all of them.
That's probably true.
Yes.
But I'm not entirely positive about it. But I have at least 4 games that contain either a Blenheim scenario or are strictly the battle.
So that was going to be my question, is how many of them are standalones for that battle and how many of them have that battle rolled into a box with a bunch of other stuff?
The only one that I think really is sort of an analogy that has Blenheim and a whole bunch of other stuff is the Horse and Musket games.
Okay.
The other stuff I have, you might have Blenheim and one other battle, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so what's the fascination with it? Why is that why is that turned into your go-to?
For the period I'm interested in, particularly War of Spanish Succession, that is the Waterloo equivalent. It is the big, most famous of the Marlborough battles. It probably wasn't his biggest victory, but it really was a pretty impressive feat of arms for the time. And it's really not even just the battle, it's even the campaign leading up to it that's really kind of impressive. So if you're interested in War of Spanish Succession and the tactics of that period, that's the game. That's the battle.
That's the one. Okay, so Jim, you're not allowed to answer all of them because I'm not 100% sure you do, but how many of the Waterloo games do you have?
Oh, I certainly don't have all of them. I mean, that's crazy because there are so many. And
I dare say there's a handful you don't want because they're probably crap.
Well, some of the ones I do own are just that. I mean, despite what everyone says, Avalon Hill's Waterloo isn't any good.
It's an
important museum piece.
Yes.
You have to play it to talk about the history of Waterloo and really about war games generally. But one of the things I pointed out in the article I wrote a long time ago about this, it uses the same combat results table as Stalingrad. So, this was back in a day when Charles Roberts and crew were slapping themes onto mechanics and saying, behold, it's a game about Waterloo. Look, it's a game about Stalingrad. Look,
That sounds almost Eurogame-ish of them.
We've come full circle. Now it's all Hanseatic wheat orgies, except we call it something else. But it sounds like I'm being critical. That's to look at the telescope backwards.
Yeah.
Because, those games are classics. You have to play them. You should try them. But, no, heavens, I've got lots of lousy Waterloo games. My collection is certainly in the vicinity of 20 now. I was actually looking this up. I was shocked. I was going to tell Doug, aha, you're out. Would you both care to guess? I'm going to deduct the game Blood Red Skies British Bristol Blenheim MK4 Bomber, which clearly is not that. But how many games on Board Game Geek respond to the search term Blenheim?
I'm going to guess it's probably up in the teens at least.
I was going to say 12, just pulling it out of my head.
And again, I'm not saying, I want to be very clear, that this is other games that have Blenheim games in them.
Right.
Yeah.
This is games that have Blenheim somewhere in the title. And the number is 7.
That's fewer than I would have thought.
Me too. And that includes the game that I'm sure is sort of starting Brant's riff here, which is the upcoming Blenheim 1704 AD from Turning Point Simulations.
Yeah, the reason I threw out a slightly higher number is that I figured there was some sort of random Hanseatic wheat orgy game out there with that in the title that had
no musket
to be seen anywhere.
Blenheim, the worker placement game.
Yeah, yeah,
Finish your rondel.
Yeah, Traders of Blenheim. With the expansion, the Merchants of Blenheim,
There you go. Thurn and Blenheim.
Yeah, the special Blenheim tax collector, unique collector card.
I'm very surprised because Doug's of course right. I mean, and I agree with him also. It's really not Marlborough's greatest achievement, but certainly it's the thing that buys him his reputation.
Yeah.
I'm very surprised it's that few.
Well, we clearly have found a niche to be filled.
Yeah.
And,
well, you do get a lot of them. Like, there's a series that, a war game company called Moments in History, I believe.
All right.
Made, two games years ago. They are Richard Berg games.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah. And they are, there's two battles in each, and they are the four major battles that Marlborough fought during the War of Spanish Succession. In nowhere in those two games, in the title, is the word Blenheim mentioned.
Yes.
And as I think about the games that I have, I can't think of any, but maybe one of them that actually has Blenheim in the title. They're all some other kind of creatively named game that just to hear about you think had anything to do with Blenheim or the War of Spanish Succession or Marlborough or anybody else.
Yeah. And there's probably at least two or three games in which, they're fought at a higher echelon that there may be a battle around Blenheim, but there's lots of the rest of the campaign before and after as a part of the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a... You know, in the games that I was counting, I wasn't even counting the... there's a game called Campaigns of Marlborough. It's a magazine game. And, yeah, it includes the Blenheim campaign. And there's definitely things like that. But there are, you know, tactical, probably a good dozen or so that cover just the battle.
Yeah.
And there definitely is one coming up that Ben Hull, that is a extension of GM Kit Pike's.
Oh.
Yeah, Hull is doing a 9 Years' War, War of Spanish Succession set of games. It's just an evolution of that series. And I've seen the playtest. So I've seen pictures of the playtest for the Blenheim.
First of all, is Ben off of deployment now?
I believe that he is back because I've seen pictures of him playtesting that at various cons.
Because he was, I know that a lot of his work was being held up because he was somewhere in the hot and dusty, serving the country and all that stuff.
I think he's back.
Well, that's great. But I'm looking here at Board Game Geek, and looks like Steve Pohl is getting ready to do his own Blenheim for Legion War Games.
In fact, I think I remarked on that at one.
Because this is, based on the pictures, as much with...
Yeah. And then there's... the one from... I have that one.
Do you?
Yeah.
This is... One of these dates and times we got to do this. These are really pretty counters.
Yeah, you're talking about the 7 Hex.
That's the one.
Yeah. Not only do I have that game, I have that game
on purpose.
That's how much you love it.
Yeah, that's how much I love it. I pre-ordered it through NWS and then forgot I'd pre-ordered it.
Yeah. I was about to say, and then you forgot.
And then pre-ordered it through Legion. And so I have it. That 7 Hex is very interesting. I watched a video the other day to try and get my head around the mix of it. Because it's sort of an interesting combination of both a hex and an area. In that you've got this collection of hex-shaped area, central hex, and then 6 hexes around the central hex. And you can only really conduct certain kinds of movement if your counters or your stack is in the central hex, which is to simulate deployment, you know, linear formation and stuff like that. But then in order to have certain benefits on defense and things like that, you have to have units in an outer hex. So it's really kind of interesting how they're using the area thing simulate some of the difficulties of deployment of linear troop formations of the period. But it is an attractive game, and the only thing I didn't really like in the video combat mechanism is one of those where, you know, there's certain number of defensive factors and number of attacking factors, and you do an equation, and then you have the result, and then based on, then you everybody takes that halved result and adds that as a die roll modifier to an attack die roll, defense die roll, and it just seemed really kind of fiddly, right? You know, you're just like,
I mean, that's just screaming for like a smartphone app assisted combat resolution.
Yeah, exactly. It just seemed like a little bit too much of the. How about we just roll some dice?
Well, and that's a shame. The reason I was saying this is because I finally pulled the trigger. I have given up trying to locate a replacement for my white box 30 Years War Quad, the original from SPI.
Right.
And so I pulled the trigger just after my interview with Don. Paulie ran at the on Armchair Dragoons. Don and I were just chatting back and forth, and he had never seen a white box 30 Years War. He didn't know it existed. And I said, no, I had one, lost it once, and then I lost another one in a Gen Con auction when the bidding went above $200 back when that was probably my weekly income.
Right.
And so he said, yeah, these days, comfortably, I would tell you that's about $250 to $300 if it's in any kind of shape. He said, if you can find one.
Yeah.
And so I pulled the trigger and bought his flat pack. He had two flat packs of it.
Okay.
So I picked that up, and I've because of Tabletop Simulator, actually, beautifully done 30 Years War Quad module, I decided, no, I want this back and sit down and play with my son and set it up. I don't, you know, it was, and I heard this on Harold Buchanan's podcast, was interviewing Mark Kerman, and I had never heard this before, and it just made so much sense to me. All the SBI quads, all of them, were purpose designed to be tournament games.
Really?
He said, all of them were built to be, even if artificially balanced at times, they were built, especially, and he said that probably the purest version of that is blue and gray.
Okay.
But 30 Years War is too. And I won't pretend that it can hold a candle to Ben's stuff and Musket and Pike, but I just love that system. I have been, you know, as if you see me, I took the Breitenfeld game with Breitenfeld last year.
Right, right.
I played it with my son right there, and I love it that much. And I really do want to get back into it. And this actually had sort of a general of that elegant simplicity period that I think is cool. And it's a shame that jacked around some of the combat.
Yeah, and it might not be bad once I play it. Like I said, it just seemed kind of fidgety to me. In not a couple of other games, like, you know, it's the same kind of thing. I just don't like systems that force players to do a lot of calculation and fractional result.
Yes.
You know, just because it adds to the time that it takes to resolve combat. And I think too many games, you know, quest fidelity in their combat, end up with combat systems that take time to resolve any single combat, and people end up getting a lot of interest.
Yeah, that is why, in fact, back in the day when I was with my blog, that is specifically why I gave up on Remember Gordon.
Right, right.
Because I loved it. I loved the, you know, heck, you talk about, what, 7 Blenheim games? You want to count on one hand how many Siege of Khartoum games there are?
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, fingers left over.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So it's, and forget about Siege of Khartoum, just that whole campaign, or the Battle of Aboukir, or the Battle of Abu Klea, Omdurman. You know,
right.
I would love those things, but there aren't many games. Oh, this is great. And then I started playing it. My wife was good enough to play it with me, and I'm going through the combat system use game, and she's wrong. And I went, God, this combat system is it's a chore.
Yeah.
There's just nothing here. I'm guessing you're trying to get away from simple combat differentials and CRT, but if that's the way you're going to go about it, you've made a bad choice.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that today, you know. Oh, we want to get away from combat DRTs, and so people are inventing combat entirely too complicated.
Yes.
You know, entirely too complicated. And then I compare it to the system that's in Waterloo 200, which we've been playing here recently, which doesn't even have dice, man.
Right.
You know, it's just wham, so simple, fast.
Well, take as another example, Napoleon 1806 from our friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, you're dead on.
You know, it's like, it's, what, 3 modifiers, maybe 4? And roll the dice. Because I, after talking to Julian, I've pretty much stuck with dice.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, there is no combat in that game that should take more.
Right. So it really keeps it moving along and makes it really interesting. I kind of ran into that same problem with the fiddly combat system when we were playing All Is Lost Save Honor.
Okay.
That, you know, really interesting, particularly if you're a student of the period. But the stack of charts just to execute a combat, you know, it took us, you know, 5 minutes every time we wanted to run through a combat. Well, is it a siege? Is it a major battle? Is it, you know, what is it really? And that there's a different model every time. And you just took all this time trying to figure all this out to the point where we kind of got bored with it and decided to play Waterloo 200.
Well, and that's a testament to how good that game is.
Yeah, well, it is, and we've enjoyed it so much, and our on gaming night that we've yet to uncrate the Borodino game and play Bloody Monday yet.
I had not gotten Bloody Monday, and then they went to their November sale.
Oh, yeah.
And they gave me the Gore-Tec map for free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually not even Gore-Tec, it's their Uber-Tec map.
Yeah.
Because I've got the Gore-Tec map for Waterloo 200.
Right.
And this is even bigger than that.
Oh, it's huge. I've got that. It's huge.
Oh, you yeah. have the Bloody Monday Uber-Tec?
Yep.
Sweet.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I got it. I got it during the Kickstarter.
And we're just going to sit here and smile and nerd at the universe. That's okay. Sorry, guys.
No, the beauty of having you guys on for a podcast is I only have to throw out like two questions in the entire hour. And somewhere in there, we might spend 5 minutes on the actual intended topic.
Right, good point.
So, you know, look, it's fine by me. It makes my editing job a lot easier. The only challenge is you guys almost never come up for air where I can actually get a couple of bumpers in here and there. So,
also fair.
But are you guys okay if we talk about Kriegsspiel, or do you want to just keep going on, you know, obscure battles that you could have made up the names to and only half our audience would know the difference?
And we're going to be less obscure by talking about Kriegsspiel?
Well,
I was going to say, this kind of gets grim now.
So most folks, you know, legit wargamers should have heard of Kriegsspiel. I'm being very careful to say should have, because we've run into at least one instance where we weren't really sure if it was an ironic question or a legitimate one.
You can imagine Doug and I staring at the person like their head had fallen off.
Well, and that's honestly happened a bunch this past summer, and we're going to kind of leave it at that because I don't want to. It's enough that, you know, we've sort of stolen some lunch money here. We don't need to kick dirt on the guy, too. So we're going to walk away at this point.
Fair enough.
So one of the fun bits of Kriegsspiel this past summer, it's not like we never talk about Origins around here or anything, but we did run a couple of legit Kriegsspiels at Origins. We've talked about them on other podcasts. It was a ton of fun. One of the more entertaining parts of the whole Kriegsspiel process was the gigantic 12-headed text conversation we had going home Sunday night about future Kriegsspiel possibilities. And my son kind of would be rolling his eyes if he was in the room because I was driving. He had my phone. He might have actually even been on his phone because he was on the group text replying on my behalf while I was trying to drive.
Yes.
And so I'm stuck in crappy traffic going through Greensboro where the highway widens out to like 8 wide and everybody takes it as an invitation to drive like they're on a NASCAR track. And I'm dead tired just trying to get home and narrating Kriegsspiel replies to my son for him to text back to the group. The idea that, yes, we've got a legit Kriegsspiel going on at Origins where we've got, I think we ended up with 8 per side. We ended up with 4 per side plus 4 umpires, right? Was that the big game?
The big game was bigger than that.
I think we had 16 total, which would have been 8 players and 8 umpires, right?
No, I think it's 6-6-4.
Is that what we did?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it was 6-6-4 at the end.
Okay. So we had a really big game of Kriegsspiel going where everybody was in their little study carols. Everybody was sort of playing blind relative to everyone else, which is the point, and having a great time with it. But then the conversations afterwards, one of the really interesting parts that I thought it came up and all that, the from the player perspective, I think everything was executed smoothly enough that everybody had a really good time playing. And the feedback we got from the participants was great. The interesting part of the conversation was the idea of sort of training people on what to do with, you know, on how to run a Kriegsspiel in the future and sort of having that Kriegsspiel Academy, I thought was a really nifty idea that could almost be turned into a convention event unto itself. And this goes back to what we were saying at the very beginning of the podcast with us being at some other conventions that we could turn the training of how to umpire a Kriegsspiel and how to be sort of the white cell control area into an actual event that we run at Origins. And so we wouldn't, for something or any game convention, so we wouldn't charge the players. We would charge the umpires, you know, whatever the charge would be for participating in that. And when they're done, you know, we give them a cute little certificate or stamp their hand with a rubber stamp or whatever the hell we want to do, right? Tattoo their shoulder blades. Whatever the official, you know, imprint shall be, that yes, they know how to run a Kriegsspiel, at least to our standards, which, you know, probably aren't the highest in the world. But I thought that was a pretty good idea. And so curious what you guys think about, you know, actually trying to pull that together as a possibility of executing that at one of these conventions coming up over the next year or so. Now, we can't just default to saying we're going to do it at Origins because, like, we'll actually be at other conventions now.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think that we may need to run some more actual game where we really have enough critical mass of people, umpires. You know, we have a few people out there that have a real interest in being them, but they know what it is, and they're really very interested. It may take another con or two where we run a few enough people that, hey, I kind of liked it. But I do think there's going to be, you know, people that would like to. I think that one of the things that we have to kind of realize is that we're talking about training people to do a very specific style of a very specific edition of Kriegsspiel.
Yeah.
You know, that you can certainly take lessons from and apply more broadly, but at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about the von Reichswitz original Kriegsspiel done at a con, which is of a different pace, and there are certain things that you do as an umpire in that scenario in order to keep the game moving and moving fast, because you're only going to have a couple hours to do it. That might be very different than you would do in another Kriegsspiel situation.
Yeah. Well, and this is also, you know, you mentioned training people for something very specific. This is unlikely to be your weekend game group getting together for a couple hours one afternoon. You know, it's just rare that you're going to have enough critical mass of people present in order to pull this off, right?
I think the thing you have to realize, I mean, I've certainly had people at my house over for Kriegsspiel. We've had Kriegsspiel days, Kriegsspiel weekends of different kinds. But that's certainly the exception rather than the rule. I'm very fortunate to have done that ever. It's indicative of how much I love it and how rare it is that I decided eventually to do it online. But Doug's absolutely right. I mean, the way Dr. Sterrett runs this stuff and the way that it winds up happening and the way we're going to train to do it is not traditional Kriegsspiel. But the truth is, almost everywhere you see Kriegsspiel played, here on the West Coast, our friends in the Southern California Kriegsspiel Society, how y'all doing? Our friends in England, who have probably the most active Kriegsspiel community anywhere, all these folks are playing accelerated Kriegsspiel. They're not, the biggest thing they're not doing is they're not doing the Reichswitz casualty calculations.
Right.
They're typically not doing it in 2-minute turns, which is Reichswitz, because you'll never get anything done in a day, and it'll slow to a walk. In fact, most of them, in my experience, I won't say all, but most of them regard the maneuver to engagement as the key piece, and they look at the situation at the time of engagement and say, okay, you won or you lost, based on how you managed to creep up on the other person. The biggest thing for me, I guess, is the parallel that I draw is always to the NDSM folks, the large mega game that was apparently mega gaming is becoming quite the thing at frontline board game cons now. It's growing in popularity. I know that our friend Marshall Neal has run them for his game Supremacy.
Yeah.
But, you know, NDSM and some of the others have run these mega games. I've played them myself. And I was struck. I was standing in line at Gen Con some years ago, and I saw a guy, he had his NDSM book out. I was like, what you doing? He goes, I come to Gen Con to play this.
Right.
Yeah.
This is why I'm here. I am not, I might check out the game hall, I have some dinner, do whatever, but as far as my tickets are concerned, 100% of them go to NDSM. And to your point, Brant, about, you know, my hero, my leader in all this is ultimately Professor Patty Griffith, unfortunately deceased before I could meet him. But he was a champion of running basically any game as a Kriegspiel.
Right.
And showing the virtues of that to a group. And is it beyond the realm of possibility that one day people could come to a con, whichever it might be, to spend a weekend playing in six different Kriegspiels? No, I would love that. I'm going to retire someday, and you know, it's that's what I would love to do, because it combines legitimate military simulation. It's not made up entirely, with a little bit of role playing, a whole lot of camaraderie, and a whole lot of learning about the nature of warfare. So, you know, I think one of the best ones I've ever participated in wasn't actually my beloved 1812, 1824 Kriegspiel. It was an ancient Roman game where a group of Roman commanders had to put down a rising in Gaul. And the Gallic tribes were run by what amounted to a bot. And the Roman centurions had to send out their legionnaires to suppress this while not losing the fort. It was sheer genius. The umpire was British, a gentleman I really like. We have partnered in the past with High Flying Dice Games. And their game, City of Confusion, was used for an absolutely excellent Kriegspiel at Historicon that I played in a couple years ago. Blew up the maps, blew up the counters, borrowed the rules in broad terms, but then ran it as a Kriegspiel. And it was incredible. And he had preset the AI for the Viet Cong.
Okay.
So again, you know, I'm all about, heaven knows, no one loves this more than I do. Some may do it as much. But there is an incredible opportunity here to open up a pool of umpires and open up a pool of players who might see the Kriegspiel as a unique way of experiencing conflict simulations that maybe they just didn't know about before.
You wound me. I thought you were going to say your favorite Kriegspiel-type experience was Persian Incursion.
I absolutely, you know darn well, I love that. It was, that's, you know, and I'm actually a little embarrassed I forgot that. I absolutely loved doing that with the crew back in the day before I was, before my role changed, how's that?
Yes.
And hanging out with those guys and really experiencing some of the absurdities that Kriegspiel lets you see in warfare. But it is, well, and now I was thinking, I was actually making notes on this when I got to work. I listened to books when I'm commuting back and forth to work, and I'm listening to Max Hastings' Catastrophe, Europe Goes to War in 1914. And boy, oh boy, if there isn't a Kriegspiel game somewhere in the path to war in August of 1914.
You know what that is? That's a blind game of diplomacy.
It almost is. It almost is. But I mean, it's in terms of, you know, and I've got the John Curry and his wargaming project out of England has published a lot of Patty Griffith stuff on committee games, table games, things of those sorts, and using the double blind model to model those historical events. And there's a ton of opportunities that would be worth exploring, even again, beyond my beloved blue and red pieces.
Yeah. Doug, I cut you off. I'm sorry. What were you going to jump in with?
Oh, no, I was just agreeing. I think there's Kriegspiel more represents a philosophy and an approach.
Yes.
And reintroduces a concept to conflict simulation that I think we don't see in the more casual gaming. You see it at cons, you see it at war game seminars, you know, connections and places like that. But the idea, and you certainly see it in professional wargaming, but the idea of the umpired game, that, you know, you can take a game and have a game master, like you were playing an RPG, and create a scenario and have a set of rules that are about something, right? There's some intent. And we call that a Kriegspiel. Other people call it other things. But certainly it's not restricted to the Napoleonic. You know, I would argue that all these years that we've been doing Command Post Wargaming, we've been running Kriegspiels.
Yes, just a rather demented version of it.
Yeah, you know, it's a computerized Kriegspiel with a very specific intent, which is to teach the U.S. Army military decision-making process.
Yeah, yeah.
What, right? Which is just as valid. I mean, what was the point of the original Kriegspiel? Right?
Sure.
It was to teach the Prussian military decision-making process.
Yeah.
So really, it's a Kriegspiel. We've got rules. We've got, you know, it's an umpired game. And from that perspective, I think there are probably all kinds of things that we could be doing, and that if we, you know, if people are really interested in learning to become umpires, there's an even broader picture of this than might emerge from the kind of very targeted or very specific Kriegspiel experiences that we ran at Origins last year. You know, what Jim and I are doing in umpiring the current Kriegspiel operational games that we're doing as forum-based games is very different than that experience that we had people participate in at Origins. It's a different game, very much.
Well, and, you know, part of this is the stuff that we do with the command post exercises at Origins, you know, instead of the dice, we've got the computer doing the adjudication instead of the BOGSAT, right? The bunch of guys sitting around a table. We've got the computer doing the adjudication, and we're fortunate that we've got that particular tool available because the code crew are part of our team. I've been part of similar projects elsewhere, where essentially it was a giant Kriegspiel going on with some computer adjudication just to help give the model a little validity, but also introducing the computer for some of the adjudication allows for far more complex factors to be modeled accurately, which matters far more in professional military applications than in a bunch of us, you know, having fun at a convention before we adjourn to the bar. So it is a different purpose, a different tool for a different purpose. But ultimately, I think any of them can be fairly engaging when in the hands of a good umpire.
And I think once it clicks with people, and, you know, Brant, you and I spent a lot of time talking about the fact that, you know, once upon a time when the Earth was new, war games and role-playing games were brother and sister.
Yes.
Before the tribes split.
Right.
And so these distinctions are ultimately false ones. and so there's always this wonderful sense of revelation. I once used Kriegspiel to teach a class at the Bristol Renaissance Fair. And it was a notional assault on the town of Bristol in 1574. And I challenged the individual players, not one of whom was a wargamer. What would you do? What would your character do? It was a theatrical exercise.
Yeah.
What would your historical character do if the Spanish indeed were believed to be coming up the inlet on their way to Bristol? Now, it turned out that I had my buddy from the 82nd Airborne. I had him as my patsy umpire running the AI for the Spanish. And so I said, you know, I would come to him and say, okay, what do you do? What do you do? But he was just so I could work out all that. But about halfway through, one of the players who I know for a fact has never been a wargamer looked at it and go, okay, what should we do now, Mr. Dungeon Master? And I said, that to me was a wonderful form of revelation for him.
Yeah.
It's like, no, yeah, no, you're right. This is the line between, you know, obviously a Dungeon Master has a lot more flexibility to make up an entire universe, but those similarities there really did, and I loved, because I couldn't play in our Kriegsspiel because at Origins because we had so many people, which was awesome. And so I stepped aside to let others play. But I loved to watch non-traditional Kriegsspielers, non-traditional wargamers step in and really get it, to understand it isn't that hard. The decisions are actually very simple. You just have to make them in a certain way. And showing people that and maybe letting them see that this is a really cool, different way of playing a game is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. And I think it can be a pretty entertaining way in which people can cross over without realizing that it's that they are in fact crossing over. One of the other chuckles that you and I have had, the people walking by the convention table and seeing the Sergeant's Minis game laid out, which it looks awesome. There's a reason we push it to a very prominent location for people to walk by and ooh and ah over it. And then you try to explain something to them and they decide that that's a little too complicated and they pick up their backpack with their 11 role-playing hardcovers in them and saunter off to some other game, you know?
Let's, my goodness. I mean, my relationship with Pathfinder is complicated. Let's put it that way.
Does your wife know you have this relationship?
Yes, she does. She, Pathfinder, and I have spent time together in a strange gaming universe. But I was watching some folks at my friendly local game store playing Pathfinder and going through the incredible run of calculations and modifiers and tables.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And they're going, wait a minute. Nobody comes after ASL anymore ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're playing ASL with elves.
Right.
You really are. I get it. There are differences, but boy, oh boy, have you boiled down these tables into your heads?
I'm imagining the debut fantasy war game from MMP, AS Elf.
There you go, Terry. AS Elf. There you go. And that's not, by the way, I am not knocking Pathfinder. If that's your jam, go get it. But to your point, Brant, then don't stand up and tell us how complicated this war game is, for God's sake. And more importantly, from a Kriegsspiel perspective, the way James Sterrett teaches it and the way he runs it, you can get into these games. Now, you'll get more if you know a lot about Napoleonics and about all this other
stuff.
Sure, you'll see a little more texture. But in terms of the choices you're making, in terms of the decisions you're being asked to make,
there's no math.
There's just, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's all what you, and what's truly beautiful, you're asked to imagine it.
Yeah.
Even if it's on a map, even if it's a piece, you know, I've been describing for, how far are we in now, Doug? 3 months into the 1809 Kriegsspiel online?
Yeah.
You know, right. we're about 3 months in. We've gone through 2 days in 3 months, so I think we're doing reasonably.
Look, based on historical track record, that's about right.
Yeah, we're clipping along. But, you know, Doug and I have both been very aggressively describing. You know, and we're using, and you know, we're not going to tell you you have lost 3 points of fatigue and 4 points of morale. No, we're telling you your men look at you like they're exhausted and that they couldn't possibly fight tomorrow morning.
Yeah. So you're dungeon mastering.
Yeah.
Now what's really interesting is the players that have had to adjust to that.
Yeah,
because they are traditional war gamers.
Yes,
and they want, you know, so
oh, they get crabby.
Yeah, are you gonna, I need you to tell me how much, what were my losses and how many fatigue points have my units, you know, acquired? Well, I'm not going to tell you that.
Yeah. Well, that,
I'm gonna
one of the great online blurbs that I saw somewhere, somebody describing a role-playing game, so going back to you guys being dungeon masters and all of this, was, you know, how many hit points do you have left? You're not allowed to say that. You know, you're supposed to describe things. You're not allowed to tell people how many hit points you have left. And so he says, well, how are you feeling? Well, on a scale of 1 to 13, I feel about a 9.
There you go. Yeah, that's it does. Some of the players, you know, initially were like, okay, well, you know, it's the end of the first day. You got to tell me, you know, how much fatigue have my units acquired and how many losses did I take in that skirmish?
Where's my number crunching?
Yeah, because I want, you know, and I was getting these tables, these march tables. You know, guys were figuring out, calculating, well, did some impressive Napoleonic staff work, right?
Right.
Yeah.
If I start marching at this time, then the next division starts marching at this time, and we're going to get this far. And I'm like, well, that's all good in theory, right? As long as what you intend to happen actually happens. Well, what do you mean? Well,
the enemy gets a vote.
Right. The enemy gets a vote. The quality of the roads get a vote.
Yep.
You know, there's all kinds of things here that are going to get a vote that you may not be factoring in, which might include me rolling a die and deciding that, you know, one of your division commanders decides that he's going to let his guys forage for an hour.
Yeah.
I'll say this. One of the biggest changes in this game, and it blew me away, you know, we're using Tabletop Simulator now, which allows us to work in a three-dimensional space, which is really cool. But one of the things that I discovered, I was used to playing the 1806 Kriegspiel, Prussians versus French, who all move on roads at roughly the same pace. All of a sudden, I'm doing the math for the Austrians in the 1809 scenario, and I'm trying to scale their little movement pieces that I build. These guys, you can barely pick them up.
That's right.
They're
lollygaggers.
And here's the thing. I've got commanders going, where are my troops? They are and then to make matters worse, one of the other things that's built into the game, a certain number of troops, it's 500 men, is, correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, that's right, it's 1,000 men is 500 feet, it's 500 meters.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got, you know, so double that, you're at a kilometer. The French, because of their organizational capacity, don't add anything to their length because of baggage. The Austrians add 50%. And as a consequence, I've got Austrian columns stretched out till hell won't have it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. They're and these commanders, bless them, especially some of these guys like, you know, our own Banzai Cats playing. Hey, Banzai, you're fine. Everything's fine. Nobody's dead yet.
But yet.
Yeah, I said yet. He's actually hanging out with Jason Pratt, which is really funny. They're together, but
that's a unit that will never move while they discuss it.
Well, but the point is, it's like, okay, we're here. Where are the other guys? Look, just smoke them if you got them.
Yeah,
because at one point, I won't say where this was and who this was. There was a commander who didn't move for a day.
Oh, yeah. We know that was Metal Dog in the last game.
Right, what Metal Dog could have moved. He just didn't.
Okay.
These guys had orders to march, but because of the slow speed and because of the length of the columns, they never got off the dime. They're sitting back in this village going, sir, is the road clear? Nope. Gentlemen, as you were.
Yeah. I had a couple the same way on the Austrian side. The Austrians don't march. They kind of ooze.
Yes.
And I've got a couple of really hard charging corps commanders who are, you know, I'm going to do this and we're going to do this. And I'm like, well, that's a nice order.
You're going to plan to.
You know, and they're always sort of grossing up their movement, right? Well, you know, I move 3 kilometers per hour, and so to move this distance, I'm like, you're moving cross country, bucko.
Oh, all you need to do is send him over to my wife, who will look at him square in the eye and say, movement penalty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've walked that ground.
I've been there.
Yeah. You were not moving 3 kilometers an hour with your Austrians across open terrain in Bavaria. It's just not happening, man.
Even the stuff that you guys are talking about in terms of these movement issues, you know, guys moving up and down the roads, how they're moving, how much extra crap they're schlepping around with them, that's got real world applications today, because one of the, honestly, it was one of the most interesting, enjoyable and informative officer professional development sessions that I was in. And this was going back almost 25 years ago now, where we had an entire 2.5 hour morning session, just the officers in the battalion, going through sort of how to do march planning to move. And we were using a brigade, so we were moving companies within battalions around, just to get a bunch of guys from point A to point B across a limited road network. And the amount of time and space planning you have to do to get unit A out of the way before unit B comes through, so you don't have Patton standing on the hood of a Jeep trying to direct traffic, it's a serious mathematical exercise that involved a whole bunch of graph paper and a bunch of lines and squiggles and sort of time and distance graphs that, you know, harkened back to high school algebra 2 kind of stuff. But it was really fascinating to see, okay, to get one of these units somewhere, this actually, it's not so much that they take up a bunch of space on the road, because that's not that hard to figure out, but how much time does it take to get all these guys past a certain point?
Yep.
And again, the way the U.S. military trained us and the way we all thought was in terms of what's your combat power, right? When you hit the LD, you're given a report on the radio, and what's your slant strength, right? How many tanks, how many brads do you have? And if you've got any mortars or engineers or anybody else with you, you tack those on. So, you know, we're hitting the LD with a strength of 10 and 4. I got 10 tanks and 4 PCs, and off we go, right? Because I'm a tank company that swapped out a tank platoon for an infantry platoon, and off we go. And that's what the command post cares about when they're tracking the battle. When it comes time to actually move that unit around somewhere, you don't just have your 10 tanks and your 4 PCs, because you've got about 5 M113s floating around out there between the first sergeant and the mechanics and the medics and whatever else. You've got a handful of Humvees. You've got a pair of deuce and a halves. You've probably got a logistics slice with you that includes at least one fueler and at least one ammo hemet. And those guys take up a crap ton of space. And so by the time you're moving your tank company around, you're moving your 10 and 4, and you're moving another 30 other random things. Those baggage trains haven't gone away. We just put treads on them.
Right. And so
everybody focuses on the combat, but the march planning is really important to get them to the combat. That's what you guys are seeing, you know, every day with the Napoleonic stuff. Let's face it, it's the same problem. It's just the math has fewer zeros on the end of it.
Right. Well, to take it full circle, to go back to Marlborough and Blenheim, the Battle of Blenheim, while Marlborough showed a certain genius in the actual battle, the true genius of that battle is that he got there at all. Because he moved, you know, he pulled an entire army out of the Low Countries, marched it through the Black Forest, and into really the same area that we're campaigning in our Kriegsspiel raid, along the Danube, several hundred miles in 1704, and got that army there and had it not exhausted, fed, very little attrition, and completely surprised the Franco-Bavarian forces. And he did that with the staff and logistics planning at a level that had been just simply not seen prior to this in European warfare since the Romans.
Yeah, and with, yeah, let's face it, with no trains, you know.
Right, right, exactly. But you know, all muscle power. But it's always fascinating to me that people start to get when they play something like this. I think it's a really phenomenal illustration of the things that get glossed over in the so much of the stuff that we read, because we read about the battles, or you know, things that we might see in movies or things like that, and we never really comprehend that an army of 35,000 men requires so much food every day.
Yeah.
And that requires so many wagons with so many horses.
Who also need food.
Right. and those horses need food. So now you've got horses that are drawing fodder for the horses that are drawing the wagons that are full of food for the men.
Yeah.
And, you know, you start to get these enormous baggage trains, and not only does it, you know, teach you a lot about the logistics of it from a military perspective, but you also begin to understand things like the devastation of the 30 Years' War, because they didn't have the baggage trains. So they were taking it from the local populace, and that's why that happened, right?
Yeah.
But beyond the military implications of it that you were talking about, Brand,
yeah.
You know, there's just a lot of implications for everyday corporate kind of stuff, the level of planning. I mean, the thing that really always jumps out at me almost every day is watching how hard it is to get something done in a Kriegsspiel, and then comparing that to how hard it is to get something done in an organization.
Yeah.
And realizing they're really the same problem.
I've actually made notes along exactly those lines because of my role in life, and I'll just give you the one that always hits me. You cannot leave your Kriegsspiel army unattended,
right?
And especially if you are the overall commander.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think that they're going to go off and do, you know, you have a plan, you worked on it, and I want to give our players all the credit in the world. They were amazing, the amount of work they put into it. And it was a great plan and good plans. But if you leave that plan unattended, you are going to wake up and there will be people that you have no – how did you get there?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you – you're fighting who? And it's just amazing. No, Doug, you could not possibly be more right. But look, I was just looking it up because I didn't know offhand. There's about 108,000 guys at the Battle of Blenheim, both sides, about even both ways. So Marlborough's moving 50,000 guys. Not small, don't get me wrong. But one of the points that is made about Napoleon as he goes on through his campaigns, and particularly after 1809, he really does lose the plot because his command, despite his core system, despite his household, is very personal.
Yes.
And he loses the capacity to lead an army of this size. When he was leading 60,000, 70,000, 80,000, even 80,000, maybe. But by the time the Grand Armée at 250,000 marches into Russia, it's out of control. He can't do it.
Yeah. Though he might try.
Right. And that goes to your point, Brant, about even now in our age of computers, we need to break down these tasks into – one of the things that his wars taught us, you have to break these tasks down into digestible chunks. But it is interesting, again, going to Max Hastings' amazing book, Catastrophe – one of the huge problems that confronted the German army as it advanced west into France, they had completely underprepared to deal with the problem of feeding the horses.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they had these beautiful uniforms, beautiful guns, tons of ammunition, and nobody brought enough fodder for the horses. They didn't think they'd need it. And by the time of the Battle of the Marne, they're slaughtering horses left and right for food because they can't feed them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so that issue of logistics and organizing and coordinating, you're just not too many games are going to give you the 10,000-foot view the way a Kriegsspiel does. So that's one of the many reasons we love them.
Yeah, yeah. Doug brought us back full circle to where we had started off discussing Blenheim. Let's face, look, not only could the two of you guys go for 3 hours on a topic like this, there's video evidence of you guys going for 3 hours on an obscure and esoteric military topic. I do want to throw the plug in for, look, one of the things we want to be able to do with Armchair Dragoons, one of the things that we are trying, one of the new things we're working towards is the idea of sharing our wargaming experiences beyond just sort of telling you about stuff at a podcast or letting you come game with us at a convention. And we want to get folks involved where we've got sort of some live gaming going on that you can watch. And you guys actually did that last weekend. As we're recording this, it was last weekend. By the time people hear this, it'll be a couple weeks in the past. And who knows, you guys have probably had another one since then. Where y'all put up the YouTube channels, each one of you. So one of you was on the Allied side, one of you on the German side. You're fighting your way through North Africa. And let folks watch and let folks interact. And I know I hopped on there for a little bit and was chatting with you guys some. I will admit that I was very wiped out that day because that was the day I went to Mace. And so I drove to and from Charlotte that day and then hung out at the game convention for a while. So I was pretty well wiped. I was lucky I was conscious long enough to drop into the broadcast when I did. But we're absolutely planning on more of those kinds of things where it's not just you guys playing a game and having fun with it, but sharing that fun with other folks. And so that's, we have the video evidence of you guys doing this for 3 straight hours, stashed on YouTube.
Great. I mean, definitely, want to do that again because, benefits to other people aside, it was a lot of fun to play that.
Yeah.
You know? And share it online and interact with people. I had also recently streamed some turns of a board game. And I plan on doing definitely more of that. Cause it's great. And it's great to see how many people were interested enough to drop in, and actually stay for 3 hours of us playing a war game.
Yeah. No, it was very cool, and so I can't tell you right now as we're recording this, sort of we're going to have a program guide on over at armchairdragoons.com, and you'll be able to look up who's going to be playing when, but, you know, my dream state is a year from now we do have something like that, and that we do have sort of the programming schedule, if you will, right? It's not quite the guide that you've got on your cable box, but you'd be able to pull up and see a couple of different options for games to be able to watch. And maybe it's the two of y'all taking on a Tiller game, and maybe it's a couple of guys with a camera looking down at an OCS map. And, you know, Gary's got a couple of his boys up in Ohio, and they've got a live OCS game going. And in the meantime, somebody else has another thing going. You know, maybe we've got a camera up in one of the game stores that we're going to be partnering with on some different stuff, and you're able to watch, you know, Minis Night over there. And just to have that option for a variety of wargaming programming that you can watch, but then ideally be able to interact with, I think is going to be pretty cool once we get there. You know,
no, one of the things I very much would like to do, and Doug and I were chatting about this briefly, just picking I certainly wouldn't call it this, but something like Saturday Night Fights.
Yeah.
Where we just pick a game, and we were just to put a plug in here too. What we were playing last week was a near-release final candidate of one of the new offerings from John Tiller Software, but done by War Game Design Studios. They're a really terrific series called Panzer Battles. This is World War II gaming done at the Panzer Leader level, the Panzer Blitz level. So the units are pretty small, and it's their North Africa 1941 game. And it's really pretty terrific. I enjoyed it, and we were able to show that off, try out a scenario, make some mistakes. Heaven knows I made some, Doug made some, and so it was learning. But it's really a neat opportunity to shoot the stuff, play a game, have fun, and really involve a community that's stretched out all over the country. So, yeah, I'd really like to do more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, guys, it's been fun. We're a little over an hour, which is fine, but we do try to keep it to roughly the length of a D.C. commute if we can do that with our podcast here. So we're, as we record this, we are saying goodnight, but, you know, thanks for listening for whatever the heck time of day you've joined us. And, so thank you, Doug.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Jim, for dropping in.
Pleasure to be here.
And so we will be back. The next one that we record, we probably still won't have a name finalized based on the poll, unless one of them happens to be a runaway winner. Well, you guys are welcome to go vote, just like anybody else who's a fan at the site. And
I wanted to be clear, neither Doug nor I came up with that name.
That's right.
No, but you've certainly glommed on to it.
We just think it's awesome.
and period appropriate for the you know, atmosphere of the website. So that's not a bad option, which is why it's one of several that people can choose from.
Fair enough.
And so we'll let folks kind of, you know, go hit armchairdragoons.com and go hit the podcast page, and you've got the ability to vote on there. And we'll probably repost that poll in other places so people have a chance to weigh in without necessarily having to follow the podcast link to do so. So come check it out, and, you know, probably another episode or two of us recording, we'll have the names settled on just in time to wrap up season one, pretty much.
Awesome.
So cool. Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody, and we'll look forward to you guys tuning in again with our next episode.